8-bit arcade graphics.
You can't do this on Nintendo Genesis Dutch.
16-bit sports action.
You can't do this on Nintendo Genesis
Dutch.
Genesis
Dutch.
Genesis
Dutch.
Genesis
Dutch.
Genesis Dutch.
Get Joe Montana free, Pat Riley free, Buster Douglas free, Super Monaco GP free, or Collins free. What Nintendo don't. Buy a 16-bit Genesis system between now and October 31st and get an extra.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of Multiple Lives Podcast. This is episode 8.5, I guess I'll call it. And we are sitting down today for a little while with Blake J. Harris. Now, if you don't know who he is, he's written a fantastic book that you should all absolutely go out and buy. It's called Console Wars, Sega Nintendo and the Battle That Defined a Generation. And if you're like me and you grew up with a Super Nintendo or a Sega Genesis, those of us in our mid-20s and a little older, then you'll absolutely love this book. It's written very well, and it just tells a story that we all know but haven't really known in detail unless you've really done your homework on it. Because as we'll talk about in this interview, there isn't that much written on this era. So, Blake, how are you today? How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely. We're honored to have you on. So I think the first question I want to start with here is just tell me about your personal history with the 16-bit generation. Did you play on the original Nintendo or Sega Master System first? How'd that go for you?
Yeah, so a lot of times people ask me, when did you start writing the book? How long did it take? And I always feel like, I'm sure we'll get into it a little bit more later, but for me, it really started years ago when I was a soldier in this battle, in this console wars. And, as you just mentioned, the first system I had was the 8-bit Nintendo Entertainment System. And I loved it so much that I wanted the Super Nintendo system when it was coming out in 1991. And, we were a Nintendo household, like one in three households in America at the time. And it was me and my brother who would play all day and all night. And I remember we kind of made our pitch to our parents, the childhood version of like a PowerPoint presentation of why we needed to get the Super Nintendo for Christmas or Hanukkah. and I distinctly remember my father saying no. And we were kind of like shocked. This was like the only thing in the world we wanted. And he said his reason was that Nintendo would then just come out with a Super Duper Nintendo and a Super Super Duper Nintendo. And, in a way, I guess he was correct.
That's right. Console generations weren't understood then. Like, people thought, okay, I bought them a Nintendo, and that's it forever, right? Like, that's how parents saw it, yeah.
Exactly. And that's obviously partially naive, but also just partially that's how things were back then. We didn't really know how the industry was going to grow. But I think that the majority of his saying no and his dissatisfaction with Nintendo was because the new system wasn't backwardly compatible. And so he felt like, oh, we've spent a lot of money over the years and now it's all useless. And so as I started to look back a few years ago and kind of think about, sort of start to look at it from a business perspective, it was so interesting to me that the reason my dad said no and the reason I was no longer a Nintendo family and I got a Sega Genesis was because of a business decision. Nintendo didn't want to have backwardly compatible gaming for the 16 bits to be able to play the 8 bits. And, they could have either passed that money, the cost on to the consumer, or their system could have cost more. But ultimately, it was a business decision. It was the reason that I was no longer a Nintendo family after saving the princess and loving so much of my Nintendo growing up, childhood. And then I got a Genesis and I became a Sega kid and I would fight to the death on the playground for Team Sega because that's how I identified myself and who I was.
So you're kind of like a turncoat then, not by choice.
I was, but because it seemed like everyone had the 8-bit NES, you didn't feel like a turncoat. I felt like everyone, like it was like a new war was beginning and then you were taking your sides, even though, yes, many of us, regardless of which system, did have a Nintendo.
Yeah, I had a bit more of a charmed existence growing up. I was born in 1989, so I was a little late for the NES. But my dad actually got me when I was 3 or 4 years old a Super Nintendo when I knew nothing about video games. So I had an easier time with that.
Yeah, so and just for your listeners, I was born in 1982. I'm 32 years old. So if anyone was curious, ages during all this, that's what it is.
Awesome. So what made you, and we'll get into the specifics later, but generally, what made you decide to write this book at this time?
The short answer is really, I wrote the book because I wanted to read this book, and no such book existed, as you alluded to. There is so little written about this era of gaming, and mostly about the history and the business of gaming before maybe the year 2000 or so. Like there is a good amount of stuff about Atari, but there is very little about Nintendo and Sega and the 80s and the 90s of gaming, which to me is the most interesting time. It's the Wild West days of the industry, and it's what really formed the mainstream video game industry that we have today. So after getting a Sega Genesis from my brother a few years ago for my birthday, which is obviously what we had when we were kids, and I hadn't played it in such a long time, it brought back a lot of memories and also a lot of questions about, you know, what had happened to Sega. I think that's what a lot of people initially wonder. You know, they're obviously no longer in the hardware business, though they still do make games. And, you know, how had they been able to compete against Nintendo? What was that battle really like, you know, when you weren't on the ground level of that? And mostly, like, what kind of drama was going on behind the scenes? So I wanted to find out all those things, and I was shocked when I walked into a big bookstore here in New York that they didn't have a single book in the entire store on video games, the history of, or the business of. All they had related to gaming in the entire store was walkthrough guides, and I thought that was kind of shocking. And so from there, I kind of started to little by little do what research I could on the internet. You know, and I would say, like, the majority of or the closest I felt like I was getting to this time period of gaming was it would say, like, Nintendo had 90% of the market, Nintendo was this gigantic company, and then Sega came along, and then 5 years later, like, Sony came in. And there was just, like, it, like, seemed to gloss over what, to me, was the most exciting part of the story.
Right, yeah, absolutely. I've noticed that, too, and congratulations, by the way, because I was at Barnes & Noble a few weeks ago, and I did see your book there. So
that's
you
wonderful.
You made a change for that. But I did notice that, too, that the only video game books written, whether in bookstores or if you find them online, is mostly about Atari, and they sort of kind of end with the advent of Nintendo, and the NES, rather, because Nintendo's been around forever doing other stuff. But I don't know why that is, because Atari, while it is interesting to read about and the crazy corporate culture they had and all that, they aren't really relevant to people anymore, because they don't the most you'll see of Atari is remade versions of their old games made by whoever owns the Atari name now. And I have never understood why people haven't written more about Nintendo and Sega, one of whom still makes consoles, the other of whom still at least makes games, you know? So I've always wondered that.
Yeah, no, and as I said at the beginning of our call before we were even on the air, you know, I feel grateful and honored that I got to be the one to do this. And I still to this day wonder why there was so little written about this era. And there are a few reasons that I can guess. You know, I think part of it is because Nintendo and Sega are both Japanese companies. So maybe there's people, maybe it's hard for me. I know firsthand it was hard to access those companies and the employees. So that was kind of difficult. And I think there's also, you know, I spoke to a lot of journalists who all seem to enjoy the book and obviously enjoy that era, and asked them why, you know, they hadn't written the book or other people hadn't. And I guess it's just so it seems like game journalism is so there's so much going on that they're so focused on the moment that it's hard for them to peel back the time and really get into yesteryear. And a part of it, too, was, you know, my biggest task at first was figuring out who I even wanted to speak with, let alone whether they would want to speak with me or how much time they would have. But because it was so hard to figure out who the players were in the story, I'm sure that was a barrier to entry for other potential writers as well.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe the reason was, and the fact that you said you're 32 years old, you're still relatively young, you're about that age when people start being interested in their childhood and stuff, and maybe we just haven't come of age yet, and now that more people like us are coming of age, maybe we'll see more histories like this. It's just perhaps the older generation didn't really care to write about what they saw as toys. That could
be it. That's definitely it, too. It's the perception of what video games were, because, you know, I do notice, you know, some of my the biggest inspirations for my writing and the writing style is the work of Ben Mezrich, and he wrote about the history of Facebook and, you know, other tech things that are happening right now. So, you know, those don't need the decades of, you know, reflection before they start getting written about. And that's because I think that we have a very high opinion of the tech sector, and we find it exciting and romantic and compelling. And that has not been the case generally for video games. As you said, it was kind of perceived as toys, especially during the Nintendo days. And, you know, kind of to me, this battle between Sega and Nintendo is the missing link between video games as toys and playthings to video games as pop culture and modern day mainstream entertainment.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, you did have to do research, like, who the hell do I interview for this? You know, who do I right. talk to? So explain, I know you can talk about this forever, but explain briefly, not too briefly, but briefly, the process you had to go through to gather the substantial amount of information that's inherent to a project like this.
Sure. So, you know, the biggest breakthrough for me early on was kind of figuring out or getting in touch with Tom Kalinske, who is basically the protagonist of the story, and he was the CEO of Sega of America from 1990 to 1996, which is the years that they went from 5% of the market to surpass Nintendo up to 60% and then started to slide back down. And, you know, beyond his days at Sega, I also would soon find out that he had helped create the Flintstones Kids Chewable Vitamins at J. Walter Thompson Ad
that
Agency.
That was him?
I mean, he was on the small team that developed it, yeah.
Oh, and, wow.
Helped revive the Barbie doll line and helped yeah. develop He-Man Masters of the Universe. So before, you know, we even really got into his time at Sega, I realized this guy probably had a bigger influence on my childhood than anybody else besides my parents. So I was already kind of fascinated with this guy. And so it was definitely a little bit hard at first to speak with Tom and others because I didn't have any book writing credits prior. But, you know, to Tom's credit, as he is depicted in the book, he's a very friendly and open-minded guy. And so after we started speaking, we seemed to hit it off. And from there, my biggest resource early on was actually one that I had used to make fun of a lot, which was LinkedIn. You know, I used to say it was like, oh, Facebook for work. But I would type in Sega or Nintendo, and thousands of employees would come up, and it would say what years they were at these companies. And it was really just like a numbers game. Probably about 25% of people responded to me. And at first, that was better than nothing. So these were I just started speaking with anybody. You know, I've always been of the mindset that, you know, there's no perspective that's not valuable. So whether somebody was a janitor at Nintendo for 1 week or whether they were the 4 years, especially at that early stage, you know, I would take anything I can get just to see the story from as many different vantage points. And so, you know, I did that for about 6 months and started to really understand what I thought this story was, you know, kind of what the narrative was and what and really also just understand the corporate culture at both companies. To me, that was a really big thing because Nintendo was definitely a more difficult nut to crack in terms of speaking with their employees, former and present. And I think that in the beginning, I was hearing mostly from the Sega perspective, and they were the bad guys in the story. They were the Goliath and the David and Goliath battle. And that's definitely true to a large extent, but from Nintendo's perspective, they weren't, you know, it's not like Goliath wakes up every day and he's like, how can I ruin people's lives and make David angry? You know, they had their own thing going on. They wanted to make great games, and you know, what people perceived as their dictatorial controlling nature was actually them, much like Apple today, wanting to control every aspect of the process to ensure a certain level of quality. So it was very fun for me to kind of understand why both companies were the way they were and how that influenced the way that they were greeted in the marketplace and by each other.
So yeah, I did actually notice that about your book. Sega was definitely the protagonist, Tom Kalinske specifically, but Sega in general was seen as the plucky upstart. Why do you think, I know that Nintendo's corporate culture has always been very, you know, closed off and silent. First of all, did you get to talk to anyone from Nintendo? And secondly, why do you think even decades later, when they know people are very interested in this story, they still refuse to talk about it? Most of them anyways.
I did end up getting to speak with everybody at Nintendo that I wanted to, with the exception of Minoru Arakawa, who was the president of Nintendo of America, but he's also the son-in-law of who was then the president of Nintendo Corporate Limited. So I kind of assumed the whole time that I was never really going to get to speak with him because he still has a familiar relation. And his father-in-law, Mr. Yamauchi, was still in charge of Nintendo at the time. But yeah, I ended up being able to speak with them, and that was took a lot of time. Ultimately, the fact that this book took me 3 years to research and write ended up working to my advantage because that gave me 3 years to try to persuade them. But to answer your question about why they're still so tight-lipped after so many years, I wonder that myself. I think that part of it is you know, it's part of the Nintendo philosophy that, like, you don't really want to shine a spotlight on yourself. And I guess, you know, speaking with a journalist in some way is inherently putting a spotlight on yourself, even if what you're doing is talking about others' achievements. But, you know, like, I'm a big sports fan, and I feel like there's, you know, sports metaphors always work well for me. But, you know, you think of maybe San Antonio Spurs a bit. I'm not necessarily comparing them to Nintendo, but the way that they deal with the media is, you know, it's more just like, we'll do the work and, you know, we'll let the work speak for itself. And that's what Nintendo has tried to do. And then, you know, you really can't forget about the fact, the dynamic between Japan and America. I think that what made Sega a great protagonist and so fun and exciting was that they really did, for a period of time, have a large amount of autonomy to run the business the way that they wanted to develop games the way they wanted to do, and to make commercials and sell them the way they wanted to. I don't believe that was ever the case at Nintendo. I think it was much more Japanese-controlled. So maybe the Americans don't think that it's their place to answer questions, or maybe they're dictated not to. And I also know that Japanese culture, it's definitely much more conservative with regards to press, and, you know, that's part of the reason that, you know, Miyamoto isn't on television every day talking about his games.
Right. Yeah, and, man, like, that's always bugged me about Nintendo. I really hope someday they open up a lot more and talk about this stuff, because I agree with you that preserving the history of this is super, super important. So we'll see what happens.
I think that one of the big things that made me come to realize is that, to me, there is a lot of similarity between Nintendo and between Apple in the sense of that control and that level of quality. But one thing that you could say about Apple that they do a lot better than Nintendo is that they really have a lot better bedside manner. And, you know, even though Steve Jobs has, you know, his personality has been described as difficult by some, you know, I think that when he gave those presentations, and I think that in terms of his relationship with the public, he was somebody that people admired and wanted to hear from. Nintendo doesn't really have a face outside of Mario that connects well with the audience. So even in a case where nowadays with the Amiibos, where there's, you know, such a small supply and people seem to be upset, I feel like if other companies were in that position, they would maybe turn that into a positive, or there would be some vocal part of the company that's coming out and talking about the situation that would make you at least feel better. And that's not something that happens at Nintendo, because they don't have that dynamic, really.
Right. So I did want to – I think the main – if there was – your book was very well reviewed, deservedly so. The main criticism I did see, and I kind of noticed myself at times, was – well, first off, let me read a quick excerpt from your author's note that starts off the book. It says, in certain situations, details of settings and description have been altered, reconstructed, or imagined. Additionally, most of the dialogue in this book has been recreated based on source recollections of content, premise, and tone. And this book is very readable because of the reason that you don't just, like, go over corporate history and say, this happened, then they released this, then this commercial. You actually go into these discussions and say, like, he said this, she said this, and it's very entertaining. But to what degree did you have to, you know, create that yourself? Was it all based on what you got from the interviews? Like, what was your process in coming up with these conversations that the book is, that the book does so well, but also received criticism from certain people?
Sure. Yeah. To me, it was very important that to tell this story, you had to feel like you were in the room with these people. I felt like to tell a retrospective or encyclopedic history was almost a disservice to them, because a lot of the great ideas and the identity of Sega Nintendo came from the energy and the spirit of these companies. And, you know, in terms of the style, I think, like, one of the biggest inspirations for me was the television show The West Wing. I don't know if you've watched that show, but to me, that's, you know, a behind-the-scenes look at the presidency of the United States. And, of course, you have the president at the top who gets to make the final say, and who political pundits say, like, you know, seem to think he's responsible for everything. But inside of the machine, you see that there's a lot of different people involved, and there's a lot of conversations that go on. And that really, you know, not just gives you a behind-the-scenes look, but it also influences how those decisions are made. And so in terms of actually crafting that in the moment spirit of the story, and so that you felt like you were in the room and sometimes even inside the minds of these people, I think it could be a very presumptuous activity to write dialogue for other people. So I would always try to work with the subjects themselves and send them chapters to make sure that it reflected what they had told me, or that in cases where, you know, if there was like small talk that was not you know, that was fictional, that it felt like small talk, that that was in their tone and in their voice, and that that was what could replace whatever they couldn't remember.
So it was true in spirit, basically. Like, though they might not have said this particular sentence, this is what they said in meaning.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that to me, that was extremely important for the accuracy and the authenticity of the book.
Right.
But it was also, I, you know, my biggest fear with the book was I didn't want to get sued by Nintendo, who's notoriously litigious, or by anybody who felt like I just was making up things about these people. So I, you know, I think that both to them and both for the readers, it was important not to do that. And I, you know, there's obviously been some criticism about it, but I definitely don't at all regret my decision to do so. And I'm really pleased with how it turned out. And but the most important reviews to me have been from the subjects themselves at Sega and Nintendo, and they have loved the book and been supportive of the book and continue to support, you know, panels and other presentations that I've given in the year since. So I consider that a success. I do think that my one regret would be I wish in the author's note I had included the fact that I collaborated closely with the subjects, so that I guess people didn't think I was just lying on a beach somewhere saying, oh, that'd be a really cool dialogue, let me just throw that in there.
All right, just, yeah, update it for the sequel that you're inevitably going to write for N64 and PS1. Yeah. That's your assignment, because I love your book, I want a sequel. this question I just actually came up with because I just remembered one of your shortest chapters in the book, maybe the shortest chapter, is with Mr. Nakayama destroying, I think it was called the Pico. Did that actually happen? Because that like, I know you said Tom Kalinske in the very next chapter talked about it, and I was like, wow, to be a fly on the wall in that situation must have been amazing.
Yeah, that definitely happened. Every action and anything like that in the book is 100% correct.
That's so...
that also, I figure of all the people who would potentially sue me, Nakayama-san would probably be towards the top of this.
Actually, he was actually a really fascinating, because a lot of this, what I got from this book, and this might be an incorrect impression, is that Sega of Japan and Nintendo of Japan and Nintendo of America, for that matter, aren't all that different from each other. The reason that I saw that the Sega Genesis took off under Tom Kalinske and Sega of America was because of the extent that they rebelled from Sega of Japan with some allegiance from Mr. Nakayama. He's the one that kind of helped them when it seems like his, you know, his colleagues on the higher levels of Sega of Japan would not have supported Kalinske. So would that be a correct understanding, you think?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely. And I think that to me, like, the two most significant moments in the book are very early on when Tom lays out his initial plan for Sega on how they could get their foot in the door and really start to give Nintendo a run for their money. Nakayama says, after Tom delivers this speech to the board of directors, that everybody in the company thinks that that's a terrible idea, but he hired Tom for this reason, so go ahead. And he basically is giving Tom a mandate, and, you know, it's ultimately his decision, so he is trusting Tom. And then later on with the Saturn launch, when things start to go very badly, Tom wants to do things differently, and this time he says no. And, you know, I think that that's due to pressure from the board, and not even so much himself, but it's still significant that he's the one in the final position to say yes or no, and he says no. And, you know, there's 500 pages between that, but that really kind of demonstrates the change at Sega over that time period. And I do think that your comparison is correct. I do think there's a lot of similarity between Sega of Japan and Nintendo of Japan, as it were, and also Nintendo of America, which is very much run by Nintendo of Japan.
All right, in the book you talk a lot about how important Sonic was, and we all know that. It's weird, actually. The Super Nintendo came out in 1991, and it's amazing how much people forget that the Genesis had actually been out since 1989.
Right.
And they treated it, and you discuss this in the book, almost like a relaunch with Sonic. And that's when you have the Model 2, I believe. That's when everyone starts getting hyped over this little blue hedgehog. That I remember, for me, for example, a shout out to Peter Bogris. The only time he's a relative of mine, and as a kid, the only time I played the Sega Genesis was at his house. And I didn't even know, I was too young to be aware of the console war really at the time, but I did like how Sonic, how fast he was, all this attitude, and, you know, attitude for then. I'm sure today he seems very vanilla, but at the time it was. For a kid, it was awesome. So do you, like, how important was Sonic? I know you talk about this in your book, but for those of people hadn't read it, would there have been a Sega Genesis as we understand it today without Sonic?
No, I don't think so. I think it would be very, very difficult for Sega to have done what they did without Sonic. And, you know, I think that speaks to the quality of the game as much, you know, to me that was Sega at its best. The game was developed in Japan, so Sega of Japan made a major contribution, especially Yuji Naka, who programmed and created the game. And then they let, maybe reluctantly, but they allowed Sega of America to really reshape the character from an aesthetic and attitude and personality standpoint. And, you know, really both groups worked in tandem together. And they had their chance to go after Nintendo, though unfortunately for Japan and significantly for America, that was when Sega began to take off, and when you probably started to notice that there was this war going on, that Sega was actually starting to succeed, whereas in Japan, the Genesis, or the Mega Drive as it was called over there, was never very successful. It never had more than 20% of the market. They really didn't harness the power of Sonic as much as Sega of America was able to. You know, it was definitely a popular game there, but it wasn't like the iconic character game that it was over here. And I think that's, you know, part of the reason that they were never able to succeed, and also kind of gives us a good experimental look at what would have happened if Sega didn't have Sonic here as they did. You know, maybe it would have been more like it was over there, where it was just a hit game and not a hit franchise and a game changer.
Right. So, I mean, that one I was just restating, like, we all know Sonic's important, but I think a lot of people in retrospect fail to see, like, just how crucial this little character was to Sega. And I love how your book also discusses the early concept for Sonic with the, you know, blonde girlfriend and all that. It was just fascinating to read. So, again, everybody, go buy this book.
Well, I think that it's, to me, the difference between Sega and Nintendo comes down to that between Sonic and Mario. Personality-wise, Sega was a lot more like Sonic, scrappy, edgy, fast-moving, and Nintendo was much more cutesy, friendly, exploratory, not necessarily in a hurry. And also just, you know, I sometimes think about, like, just the fact of their names. You know, what's Mario's name? I guess, is it Mario?
Right.
Like, but Nintendo didn't really care about that. That Mario's name came after the game Donkey Kong was already created, and they just, you know, they didn't work. They were product development driven. They weren't marketing driven. Whereas what you're talking about with the Sonic, the version with the fangs and the version with Madonna, that all came from a marketing perspective. Sega intentionally wanted to create something to go against Mario. And so they came up with a character or several characters and ultimately decided on Sonic. And he was, you know, intentionally designed to beat Mario. And his name was Sonic, the middle name, the Hedgehog. So everything about Sonic was intentionally designed to satisfy this desire, whereas Mario was a game, you know, essentially a character from a game that was designed to be a game, and then everything else was decided after. And that's a lot of what the different philosophies are between Sega and Nintendo, the marketing versus product development.
Yeah, in many ways, I see the Genesis, even the console itself, because if I have since bought a Genesis after I read your book. Actually, I remembered how much fun I had with my relative's Genesis when I played it once a month or whatever, and I ended up buying it. Now I have some games for it that I plug in from time to time, and the Genesis still looks really good. Like, it is the antithesis of the Super Nintendo in that my Super Nintendo now looks yellow and purple because the colors changed, but. The whole corporate culture of Sega of America seemed designed to be just the opposite of Nintendo, whereas Nintendo would say originally, not later, but you can only make two games a year for the Genesis. That was very important for the NES, and that was very important for Tom Kalinske to get, you know, other companies to make games for him. Sega's games were also kind of the opposite. I didn't see as many RPGs for the Genesis, or the ones that are there are much more well hidden than, you know, SNES's famous RPG library. They had more sports games. They had the better version of Mortal Kombat, which I just remembered because of the new one coming out. It was just, you know, and I think that is what your book highlights best, in my opinion, you know, so.
Yeah, no, and I'm glad that it was perceived that way, because I you know, because it was written the style it was, I rarely laid out, here's what Sega is, here's what Nintendo is, but I'm hoping that readers reached that conclusion that you did, because that's one that I did as the writer and researcher, and that's how I believe the you know, dichotomy exists.
So chapter 41 opens up with a very, very angry Tom Kalinske saying, "What is wrong with Sega of Japan?" And, you know, we all, like we talked about, their corporate culture was very similar to Nintendo, more locked down, more, you know, antagonistic towards him. Had Sega of America continued to hold the upper hand in their relations with Sega of Japan, and they hadn't been forced to take on their Sega of Japan's bad ideas like the 32X, do you think things could have been different today? I know it's hard to predict the future from 20, like, to just change one thing and have the whole future change, but do you think Sega could potentially still be making consoles today? Would the Dreamcast have been a bigger success? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I definitely think that. I mean, the two greatest what could have beens to me in the book are the Saturn, and that, you know, it could have essentially been the Sega PlayStation with Sony, or it could have been the Sega 64. It could have been, you know, having the chip with Silicon Graphics that became the N64. So, yeah, I think that if Sega of America had been allowed to go forward with either of those ideas or problem solve in a different way, they still would have been relevant, or at least much more relevant. The real question is, what would it have taken for Sega of America to maintain that upper hand? Because clearly it wasn't just success, because they were finding success. So it wasn't a matter of, like, they lost their grip and they had that control taken away. It was almost that they were too successful as a subsidiary in the face of the parent company. So I've spent a lot of time wondering what could they have done differently, like where did they really go wrong? And it's hard to find a rational answer.
Right. I mean, for me, they went wrong because they had to eventually, you know, listen, take orders from Sega of Japan. And that's why the impression I got is that's why Tom Kalinske ended up leaving, too. You know, he didn't feel and I know earlier in the book you have Al Nielsen saying how Sega of America didn't feel like Sega anymore. Like they felt like an old company rather than, you know, an exciting new company. So right. That was almost sad. Like, your book kind of ends on a downer, man.
Well, that's the trouble with doing rise and fall stories. Yeah. You know, it's not usually going to end with riding off into the sunset. But at the same time, because the book was so much about people, as much as it was about these companies, I felt like each of them had sort of their own happy ending in a way.
Right. Sorry, I already asked that. Okay, the other thing I really, really wanted to talk about... the Sega Genesis is infamous, besides Sonic, besides, you know, being the rebellious company, was the legendary ad campaign, the Genesis Does, the commercial that made fun of Mario Kart, even though Mario Kart is fantastic. Yes, I am going to defend Super Nintendo a little bit. you know, they just went right at Nintendo, and... It's interesting because in other fields, other corporations had been doing this kind of advertising, like attacking the other companies or the competition for a while at this point. Why were video games, why was Nintendo so caught off guard by this? And why was it so revolutionary in the video game industry to make ads like this?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, I think that even in any... industry, it's some people look down upon head-to-head competitive advertising, and then especially in Japanese culture back then, I think it was very much looked down upon, and that's why Sega of Japan did not do that in Japan and did not really approve of what they were doing in America. But I think the real answer is you need to have substance when you do that. You know, just saying that something else is bad doesn't make your thing good necessarily, nor does it make it true if you say your thing is good. And you know, but the two things that you just described, the Genesis Does What Nintendo Don't campaign and the blast processing anti-Mario Kart thing, you know, there was 2 years between that, and the Genesis Does thing actually predates Tom's time there, and
right,
that
right.
was mildly successful, or I guess it was very successful because you and I and a lot of people remember it, but that was still before they started selling the Genesis, so maybe people remembered it, but it wasn't actually successful. But after they had Sonic, and after they had the Welcome to the Next Level campaign, and after they had these great sports games, and after they really had everything to back up what they were saying, or to back up that they thought they were better than Nintendo, or could differentiate themselves from Nintendo, that's when it really started to take off. So I think that it was a matter of creating that infrastructure so that when you go, you know, when you light that fire and you're ready to fight, that you actually have the ammo to battle.
And a lot of what you are, like, You mentioned in passing earlier that there could have been the Sega PlayStation because Sony was in talks with Sega until Sony ended up firing the person that was in talks with them and everybody else afterwards. But you mentioned that in passing, and we also know that Sony had talked to Nintendo, and Kutaragi had made the sound chip for the Super Nintendo. So we know that there was a lot of these tie-ins, but eventually, a lot of this competition, the reason Sony exists in the video game space is because of an insult, a perceived or real insult from Nintendo.
Right.
And a lot of what happened with Sega of America was also based on, you know, these strong personalities clashing. And for a while, Kalinske had the upper hand, but eventually he lost it. And I have to wonder if in another 20 years from now, somebody writes about the history of Xbox versus PlayStation 2 or whatever, you know, whatever. Is it still personality driven now? I know you're not an expert in that,
right,
that time period, but do you think your book states accurately how important these personality clashings were to this generation, the famous 16-bit war?
I do. And like you said, you know, I'm not very much aware of what's going on nowadays, where I by no means consider myself an expert. But I think the importance of the executive and the personality has been mitigated because of just the level of investment that goes into these things nowadays, which it automatically increases the number of cooks in the kitchen and the number of people who have to turn their keys before a decision is made. And also just the way that video games are covered. You know, yeah, there were a couple of news stories when Nintendo publicly snubbed Sony in 1991 at CES, and there were no stories about meetings between Sega and Sony in 92 or 93. But, you know, I think nowadays it'd be very hard for a large-scale company to meet with a competitor or to meet with other industry bigwigs without it having been reported upon, or even from their perspective, you know, leaking stories or having it teased. You know, there's so much more emphasis on sort of strategically working the press and, you know, creating partnerships. I think that's why I love the fact that it was much more like the Wild West back then, that you can get away with a lot more, and that things changed much more quickly because nobody was really supervising all that much.
Right. Yeah. And I think now the corporate structure, the way video games have become such a multi-billion dollar business, and I guess I can turn this into a question. Can a Sega Genesis ever happen again in today's world?
I don't think it really could happen in the console space.
Right.
Because it's just so expensive to get into. You know, it back then the cost of making a game would be maybe $1 million or towards the end of the 16-bit era, maybe a few million dollars. Nowadays it's tens of millions of dollars. And that doesn't even include the marketing industry. I don't think that there really could be a Sega-like startup in hardware for consoles. But I think that where you might see similar stories might be in the mobile space, or there's still opportunities in the gaming space. There's PC gaming, and there's mobile gaming, and there's obviously still console gaming, and there's upcoming virtual reality gaming. So, you know, I think that those kinds of battles and those kinds of underdog stories will still exist in the gaming space, but it would be very hard to do so in the hardware space. But, you know, I've been wrong about things before, and I would happily be wrong about this. I'd love to see someone come in and shake things up.
Yeah, we should get Tom Kalinske back on the job.
Yeah.
I'm sure he'd love that. Actually, how does he... I don't really know much. I know your book talks about his time at Mattel, the very, very interesting story with how he found the factory making the, you know,
right,
counterfeit toy cars and stuff. What has he been up to since then? I know this isn't directly related to your book, but has he done anything else with video games, or has he moved on from that industry?
For the most part, he's moved on from that industry. I mean, kind of going back to your point earlier about how video games were toys, he is, you know, he was called the prince of the toy industry, and he was like this amazing toy guy that did have that influence on all these toys from my childhood. So when he came to Sega, or when he went to Sega in 1990, it wasn't that much of a shocking move. Yeah, he didn't know the video game industry, but that was kind of just like a subset of the toy industry. And through Sega, he was able to transform that into more of a mainstream, big entertainment industry like music and like film. And so maybe now it seems a little stranger of a move. But after that, sorry for the spoiler alert here, but you know, he ends up working for Larry Ellison and Michael Milken to essentially find companies, new startups that combine education and technology. And one of the companies that was formed was LeapFrog, and he helped shepherd that company into existence and success. And he was at one point the CEO of LeapFrog, which made the Leapster and the LeapPad. And he's still on the board over there. So that's like, tangentially related to gaming. It's obviously not the kind of gaming that he was doing at Sega. But he still seems to be working as hard as he was back then. He's always busy. He's always working on fun, interesting stuff. And it's usually somewhere between the tech space or the education space.
Gotcha. Yeah. And actually, I read your book almost a year ago now. You did actually talk about his interest in education. In fact, the Pico, the thing that we talked about, the Nageyama smashed, was actually very much related to that. And that's why he was interested in selling it for $100, I think it was. But they couldn't quite meet that price. And,
what helped put LeapFrog on the map was essentially a version of the Pico that retailed for $100.
Right.
So it did come back later on in his career.
Non-smashed form, yes.
Yes.
Exactly. The other major character, and sorry, we'll wrap up soon. I don't want to take up your whole day here.
It's fine. Don't worry.
So the other major character that it was very... not. I say character because your book reads so much like a novel. These are real people. I'm sorry.
The other
person in this story that... that was super fascinating to me was Nielsen. And I've actually seen, before that, I didn't realize it was him, but I love looking up old YouTube videos of news stories of how the coverage was of video games back then. And he was in this one video where he was playing Moonwalker. It was actually very interesting to see these, and just the coverage back then was hilarious. And they were toys to these newscasters. They didn't see them as, you know, art the same way a lot of people see them today. So what?
Well, to like put into perspective what video games were back in the late 80s and early 90s, I've thought of it almost like the childhood boy equivalent of a tea party. Like, my dad would sit down and play Mario with me and my brother, but it was the way that like a parent would have a tea party with their daughter, where like they really are enjoying the time, but it's also like a little bit like, this is ridiculous. I can't believe that this is what they enjoy. You know, that's how they kind of saw it. And that's so fascinating because, in a way, you know, video games still have the same function of sitting in front of a television and playing these great graphic things. But the way that parents view them and the way that adults and newscasters view them has obviously changed over the past couple of decades.
How they view them has. I would argue that the majority of people who don't like video games haven't actually played them. I know my dad, when I was a kid, would play Super Mario Brothers with me and love it, and then he would play it by himself afterwards, but to this day insists he doesn't like video games.
Right.
My girlfriend, I handed her the controller on when I was playing GTA 5 a while back, and she just went on a rampage and loved it. But Grand Theft Auto there. And she loves Mortal Kombat too. So yeah, I'm of the opinion that I would actually disagree. I think that's just prejudice speaking, and you know, could be both. I'm sure there are people that legitimately find video games boring, but you know, we can't all be normal. I do have to ask, I know you might not be able to talk about this, but your book opens with a foreword by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, and it made big news last year that they would maybe be making a movie. I don't know if that's locked down. And then I heard you talk about in other interviews, like I know you were on Back in My Play, a documentary perhaps happening. Can you give us an update on either of those, or is that still on the down low?
Oh, no, I'm happy to tell you as much as possible, though there's not too much to say at this point. So we are doing two movies with Seth and Evan, and it's a documentary and a feature film. We've already shot all the interviews for the documentary, and I've been editing that with my co-director, Jonah Tulis, and we're, you know, hopefully reaching the conclusion of that, and it's coming out great. We're going to have a 90-minute feature or documentary film, feature-length film. And then in addition to that, Seth and Evan are attached to write and direct a feature film version of the book for Sony Pictures. All the contracts have been signed, and that's hopefully happening. We'll see when that happens, or, you know, in the film world, if it really does end up happening. But so far, so good. And we've been working with them for a few years now on the documentary, and it's been a great relationship. And, you know, I'm as confident as ever that all that will come to pass. So
that's awesome. So we are for sure getting at least the documentary and possibly the movie. That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. And the last question I wanted to ask you before I let you get on with your day here is, you, in the book you talk about the most fascinating thing, for example, that I learned about in the book was the Sega Channel. And I'm just thinking, like, wow, in the early 90s they had a system that you could download games onto, and that's just, it just seems so crazy because I didn't even consider that that was a thing until the Xbox 360 and maybe the original Xbox a little bit, but really online downloads started to take place around 2005 for me. So Sega, in a lot of ways, was ahead of its time. You saw that with the Dreamcast later, with, you know, a lot of the stuff it did,
right.
And you saw that as early as the Genesis. What do you think, in your opinion, is their biggest contribution more than anything else to the video game industry, something that still has a lasting legacy to this day?
I very sincerely think the biggest impact that Sega made is, like, kind of what you just described about your father. So playing, you know, he'd play Mario with you, and then he'd kind of play Mario by himself but not admit it. And the way that they made gaming cool and acceptable for people that weren't kids. Like, I think that, the you know, one of their marketing advantages or their strategies was to make it, you know, welcome people to the next level, show them that gaming is no longer just for kids, that, you know, Nintendo could have the kids and they would go after the teens and adults. So it was, on their part, you know, sort of selfish for them to try to create this market space, but I think the lasting impact is that gaming is no longer just for kids. And of course, part of that is because us kids grew up, but at the same time, I think that the way that people think about gaming is much more like film and like music than it would have been completely without Sega. And even just look, you know, I have a Wii U, so I really love Nintendo and Nintendo games nowadays, but the kinds of games they make are still family-friendly childhood games, and Sega was the one that really started making adult-themed games, whether it was Mortal Kombat with the blood or whether it was Sewer Shark and Night Trap or other games that ended up getting them in front of Congress. You know, they did make more adult-themed games. They also made a lot of great sports games, and then it was almost like, you know, Sony kind of took the baton from them or stole the baton from them and continued making more and more mature games, and games that really are for people that are not just kids. And I think that's their biggest lasting influence.
Right. Sorry. You can probably hear my dog screaming right now. The ambulance drove by and they feel like they need to help. They'll shut up in a second. I had to mute myself. But yeah, I heard your whole answer. Yeah. And like we talked about earlier, just even the look of the console, you know, this black little awesome looking machine. I obviously went through other iterations, including one that wasn't even made by Sega. It was made by, I forget who, the Genesis 3. And yeah, I think you're right about that, because a lot of their tech, like the Sega Channel and other stuff, would come to be the main practice later, but probably didn't really matter at the time too much. You know, that's why we don't think of Sega Channel and stuff. But it really is such a fascinating little company, and it makes me terribly sad that they don't exist anymore. You know, not in the, I mean, Sega exists, but Sega of America, for all intents and purposes, probably died when Tom Galinsky left. Like, that company, the Dreamcast was cool, you know, and so was the Saturn, but it wasn't the same. You know, it wasn't really the same as the Genesis. It never really caught that fire again. And maybe you just, you know, maybe it's just too hard for, you can't be an upstart forever, you know. I guess that's how it goes.
Yeah. Sad for me to write, knowing what it was and what it could have been, and to sort of look through the black box and see all the places. Yeah. It's unfortunate.
Anyways, Blake, thank you so much for being on. I know we're just this little podcast, so it's really cool of you to come and talk to me today about all this. What's your plan going forward? You said you're editing the documentary.
Editing the documentary, and I'm hoping to start writing a new book soon. I'm sorry to say that it's not about gaming, though. Dang, I would love to write a sequel to Console Wars or a few sequels. But for right now, I'm going to be turning in a book proposal in the next week or so, and hopefully I'll get to share what that is if all goes well.
Oh, so you can't tell us right now what it is?
No, but I'd love to, so I'll come back another time and tell you more about it.
We won't tell anyone. No, just kidding. Well, I wish you luck with that book. I'm sure it'll be fantastic. And hell, I'll read it. I really like your writing style, so you can probably make another industry interesting, too. I mean, I don't know if you're writing about an industry, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, that's the plan. But I do, I would love to write another video game book. I think that initially I didn't think so, because I thought this was to me, the most interesting part of gaming. But as I learn more and more, there are still so many interesting things that haven't been written about. And at the least, I hope that my book inspires others to do so or creates a market for publishers to want to do so. But I would definitely like to write more at some point.
Awesome. Well, again, the book is called Console Wars, Sega, Nintendo, and the Battle That Defined a Generation. Like I said, guys, you can find it. Some Barnes & Nobles have it, but if not, Amazon, of course, will carry it and most other online booksellers. Blake, thanks again. Everyone go buy his book, and we look forward to seeing that documentary and hopefully a movie. Thanks, man.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Have a good one.
You played every Mario game. You conquered every Mario game. You think you've mastered all there is to know about Mario. Well, you better think again. New Super Mario World, made possible by the power of the Super Nintendo Entertainment System. You've never faced the challenge of so many enemies, so many obstacles, so many levels. You've never needed help from a dinosaur before. Super Mario World, you get it only with a Super NES. It's part of the growing lineup of games for the next generation from Nintendo. You've gotta play it. You've gotta have it. You've got a reputation. Now you're playing with power. Super power.
The Sega Genesis has blast processing. Super Nintendo doesn't. So what's blast processing do? And what if you don't have blast processing?